This is the Awful Announcing Podcast.
Three-pointer!
Oh, Hutchins! Double honor!
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, wow! In your life have you seen anything like that?
Oh! LeBron James with no regard for human life!
Welcome to the AA Podcast.
Maddie, what are you still doing here?
Here's Matt Yoder.
It's an annual tradition here at Awful Announcing that for our last podcast of the year, we welcome in the supreme leader of sports media writers, Richard Deitch of Sports Illustrated, for our Year in Review podcast. Fortunate enough to have Richard with us once again for the 2014 special. Richard, welcome back.
Well, first, Matt, thanks for the invite. Secondly, I mean, at a certain point, you guys really should be able to get better guests. I mean, you are a major website. You interact with major players in the sports media. And so I feel like, I mean, while I'm flattered and honored that you're giving me your, you know, podcast airwaves to speak, I feel like at this point you could certainly go much bigger than me.
This is us remembering our humble beginnings, Richard.
Oh,
yeah, we could go and get the Jim Nances and Marv Alberts of the world, but
right.
You know, we
is a Chris LaPlaca not available? I mean, I feel like you guys can do much better.
You know, I don't think I have Chris LaPlaca's number.
1-800 ESPN.
I think the army of ESPN PR folks, howdy to everyone listening, is on my case. So I usually have, you know, a few folks contact me from the 860 area code. But not the top, not LaPlaca. So, you know, maybe that's why, you know, you humble yourself here, Richard, but you really are at the top since you have that connection there.
I'm not sure Chris LaPlaca calling me puts me at the top of anything. But I will say, though, whenever I'm at the office and I see the 860 area code, it is fun because I know that that conversation is going to always be interesting when I see that area code on my dial.
You know, I was going to start this podcast with a Ravel joke, and I'll get that in shortly.
Is that a Spanish phrase or something? I'm not very familiar with that name. What is that exactly? Is that some kind of a dish that they serve during Christmas or Hanukkah?
Yeah, I think it's something I found on Urban Dictionary. Something to do with branding and, you know, things like that.
Yeah, sometimes I'm not always current, so that name almost sounds like a boy band from the 90s, but it's not ringing a bell today.
All right, let's get to this. Let's be honest with ourselves and the listeners.
All right.
Darren Ravel finally throwing in the towel and blocking you on Twitter. Have you recovered yet from that block?
Thankfully, I'm the son of a shrink. My mother is a psychologist, so I've had to undergo a lot of extra therapy, you know, between, you know, Freud and Skinner and everyone else. And I've been diagnosed left and right. So, yeah, I'm back on the right path. But, you know, in all seriousness, that is true. Mr. Darren Ravel did block me. And as I tweeted out, and I think I blocked, you know, I'm among a pretty well-known list of people he's blocked.
It's not exactly a very exclusive category.
No. Bruce Arthur and many others in the media. But I mean this sincerely. I do think it's probably best for both of us, you know, psychically and emotionally to take a break from one another. You know, you, Matt, are a big fan of professional wrestling as I am. And there's a lot of value, by the way, in, you know, your professional wrestling characters going away for a couple months and, you know, sort of giving the characters a new spin or giving the audience a little bit of a break. So in this sense, it's probably a good thing. And then beyond that, in all seriousness, while it's fun to battle with Ravel, there are times where even I'm kind of like annoyed at myself for being in the midst of it because I feel like I become a little bit caricaturish in going back and forth with him. So there really is benefit in all seriousness to sort of stepping away from that. And I haven't seen Ravel's feed in a couple weeks. I couldn't tell you what he's doing. I would imagine he's probably doing the same thing and, you know, battling with the same types of people. So so in that sense, it's a good thing. I think it's probably for both of us, I think the fresh air has been pretty good.
Well, if we follow the story arc here, if Ravel does return, there's got to be a heel turn in there somewhere. Maybe Ravel comes over and joins forces with you against Jay Mariotti. You know, something like that is going to happen in the next few months. We can only hope.
This is why you are the Paul Heyman of sports media beats. You're all on top of the storylines.
I like that. All right, let's get to the big stories of 2014. And I think two of the most impactful, certainly in the NFL world, first, Michael Sam's coming out. Second, the NFL's domestic violence crisis and the mismanagement from Roger Goodell. Let's deal with the latter first. It might be a bit impossible to give the media a grade as a whole in how they covered this crisis throughout the fall. But from your chair, what were some of the highlights and lowlights of the media's coverage of those Ray Rice and Adrian Peterson stories?
In the last couple of weeks and months, the reporting's been pretty good, led by Don Van Natta and Kevin Van Valkenburg of ESPN. They've really, in particular Van Natta, sort of shed light on a lot of the behind-the-scenes shenanigans regarding what the NFL knew, what the NFL didn't know, what the Ravens knew when they held their press conference, and what they did with their decision to ultimately release Ray Rice. Where I think the media failed, and it's a collective failure, put Sports Illustrated in there too, is that we really didn't do a good job beforehand of exposing or illuminating on all these domestic violence cases in the league. It's not to say they went uncovered, because they certainly newspapers and other places would, mention when somebody was arrested or somebody was charged. But there really was not a very good spotlight on this situation until the Ray Rice video emerged, and it emerged only because of TMZ, who you'd have to really give your sort of props to for the year because of that tape and the Donald Sterling tape. To me, at least with the Rice stuff, the last couple of months, we have not had, some bad hot takery basically going on. I think there's been a lot of really thoughtful discussion. I think ESPN has really done well on that. I think eventually, while the NFL is not per se covered hard, in my opinion, the domestic violence stuff, I think there's been an aggressive and a smart aggressive tone by the media. We saw that during Goodell's first press conference after his first adjudication with Rachel Nichols' questions. Norah O'Donnell's interview was excellent on CBS. So this is not a league that's, generally speaking, used to getting this kind of treatment. I mean, I think the league generally is used to what we saw with them and ESPN and the Frontline special. I think they're used to getting their own way and their partners sort of doing their thing. But for the most part, I think the coverage eventually has been pretty good. I will say one last thing, Matt, on that. You are not going to find the rights holders, Fox, the NFL Network, CBS, really discussing Roger Goodell's future on pre-games and post-game stuff. I think the only places you're really getting that healthy discussion as to whether Goodell has abdicated his responsibilities is, generally speaking, online from some mainstream places, including ESPN.com, but a lot of independent-type commentary. I think that's where you're seeing that kind of work. So I think in general, after a certain point, I think the coverage of Rice has been pretty good, but we're all should be taken to task for the fact that there was not enough focus on domestic violence issues in the NFL before this.
You touched on a couple times there this relationship between the NFL and their rights holders, specifically ESPN, and some of the past times where we've seen the league strong arm Bristol. This time, though, with Roger Goodell, we've seen Keith Olbermann call for his resignation. We've seen Outside the Lines continue to push the hammer down as far as the investigative reporting goes. Are you surprised in which the network has shown so much fervor in going after the league and holding Goodell accountable? I mean, even reporters like Chris Mortensen and Adam Schefter kind of throwing their hands up in the air with everything to deal with the second video from inside the elevator. Are you surprised that there's been so much heat coming from Bristol towards the NFL through this crisis?
I'm not surprised, because the people who are putting on the heat, I think, have had a history of doing that. Overman's given a lot of freedom and create, a lot of freedom and autonomy on his show to talk about what he wants, and he's clearly been very early and active when it comes to Goodell. I think the really good reporting by people like Jane McManus, and again mentioning Van Natta and Van Valkenburg there, you know, there's a lot of independence in the investigative outside the lines community at ESPN. What has been interesting on this case is, you know, you're right, we have seen, I would say more Schefter than Mortensen, but we've seen some traditionalists, you know, of at ESPN, including not many, but a couple of ex-players, really put the hammer to the NFL, to the league. That's something we don't often see. I would still say, though, the majority of, you know, the good thing is ESPN, because it's so big, there are going to be people out there who sort of have the autonomy and freedom, if they have that standing at their place, to, you know, to really act as kind of independent arbiters. And then there are going to be people at that place, because they just have so many ex-jocks and ex-coaches, who kind of, you know, take the league viewpoint. So I think you got a mix of both. I'm not that surprised, but let's not, you know, Matt, I mean, yeah, you guys chronicled this really well. Let's not pretend that the Bill Polians are still not out there going, oh, after the break, I misspoke. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, hey, everything's all good. Or, you know, in Fox's case, which you guys did a great job of exposing, Frank Luntz's, you know, Roger Goodell's performance was the greatest speech since Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy, and Alexander the Great. I mean, like, so that stuff still goes on.
That Luntz thing was just unbelievable, and really, I think...
I mean, like, to be honest with you, it was so unbelievably bad that you would think it's not real, but yet it was real.
Exactly, and we'll get to Fox Sports 1 later, but for a network and for a company, Richard, that is trying to gain respectability, to put on a paid consultant of the NFL to grade the NFL commissioner's press conference was unconscionable to me, how they could make that decision. And I listed it as one of my worst media moments of the year. And you could really put that for any year, putting Frank Luntz on the air in that situation. I don't know how Fox Sports allowed that to happen. Okay, one more tangent.
It's management not doing its due diligence, or it's management thinking that the viewers don't care. But there are people out there who do care, and there are people certainly who watch Fox Sports Live and will note if they do something ridiculous. And in this case, I didn't even end up talking to management about this, but you would hope that management somewhere knows that they totally screwed up.
One more tangent before we circle back to Michael Sam. ESPN often asks us to compartmentalize what they do. As a whole, though, in 2014, was it a strong year for ESPN journalistically? We've seen the Don Van Nattas of the world get a lot of important play. We've seen Outside the Lines lead the way in some of this reporting. But we've also seen Jay Glazer sound the alarm bells again. We're dealing with the ESPN and media reports stuff now. I thought some of Robert Lipsight's final words as ESPN ombudsman were fantastic, and hopefully the network takes them seriously. But can you give us a airbrush picture of ESPN's year as a whole journalistically, given we always had this fight between the good and the bad at the network?
It's hard to honestly do that, because they do so much content that you can find good and bad every day. What I would say is that there are places in ESPN, and I've always said this, that when they're at their best, nobody does it better. In my end of the year column, you know, I cited 5 pieces. I probably could have cited 50 that I considered the best news, you know, the best kind of long form features on a news program of the year. The top award I gave was to the Lauryn Hill feature done by a really talented producer named Ben Weber. Words written by Tom Rinaldi. You know, Jeremy Schapp did an incredible piece with Bean Gim, who's a really good producer there, on migrant workers dying in Qatar to build the World Cup. Obviously, we mentioned Van Natta. Obviously, we mentioned Van Valkenburg. You know, you go down the list, whether it's Wright Thompson or Seth Wickersham. There's, you know, Jane McManus. The thing is that Kate Feagan, the thing is about ESPN, they have more firepower, really solid reporting firepower, than any other sports place around. And they have it by a lot. And I mean, I work at a place that really cares about sports journalism. But those guys have numbers. They have an army. They have numbers that nobody else can touch. So on any given year, you can give them an A-plus for their work, because they're going to do A-plus work all the time. I mean, you know, these guys, you know, two guys, Willie Weinbaum and Mike Fish, track down one of the shooters of Pat Tillman. Convince that guy to go on the air for the first time ever. I mean, that's incredible journalism. At the same time, the problem with ESPN is that they're so big that there's going to be so much nonsense that happens on that network that really is the antithesis of good journalism or good editorial. And it ends up, I think, hurting all of them, you know, from the knuckleheads in the morning when Stephen A. Smith starts dropping things like, you know, women need to not provoke domestic violence. When Bayless says, you know, one of the 700 things he says stupidly during a given year. When you have, you know, knucklehead analysts just shouting out hot takery stuff. When you have, you know, Lou Holtz and Mark May putting on a bad vaudeville act that wouldn't work in a 1920s diner. You have to all sort of mix it up. So, you know, it's a hard question to answer, Matt, because, you know, they do A-plus work every year, every week, but then there's a part of their place that is F-work every week. So when you, how do you sort of combine all those worlds to give one grade? You know, the last thing I would sort of mention in terms of the media report stuff, which I know Jay Glazer hits on, and Lipsight, et cetera, and I hear from ESPNers all the time, because I'm somebody, obviously, who points it out like a wise ass, and I'm admittedly trying to, you know, do a little bit of Vince McMahoning.
You never, never, Richard.
Stirred up and talk, but there's a reason I'm doing it. And I always acknowledge that ESPN absolutely gets attribution swiped from them. For whatever reason, their reporters don't, you know, they privately try to email people like me and others to do their bidding. I would say that they should go out publicly on Twitter and fight for themselves when they get swiped. But there really is, it really is a ridiculous policy to cite clear, definitive breaks from other places as media reports. I realize sometimes it's hard to figure out who broke something first. I get that. And that's probably hard for all of us, and you got to give people a pass on that. But there have been too many times where it's definitively this outlet or this person who broke this story, and ESPN, maybe they'll initially cite that place, but generally not, and then we'll go to the, you know, to the overarching tag media reports, and then trust me, 4 hours later, it becomes an ESPN story. Mm. And that's just I feel like that's just dirty pool, and I feel like the place that has the resources to do it best should not head down that path.
Exactly. I think that's what's so frustrating about it when you look at it from the outside. All right, I want to make sure we touch on Michael Salmon. Don't forget about that story. Richard, to me, maybe the biggest takeaway from Michael Sam's coming out was how well put together it was when you have the ESPN, the New York Times, the timing of it, how it was done. It just seems to me like it was very well crafted and well organized. Now, the story maybe took some turns along the way that weren't so great when you look at some of the anonymous sources coming out, what happened surrounding the draft, and of course now, you know, not playing it down during the regular season. What was your biggest takeaway from Michael Sam's coming out, how the media handled what is such a meaningful story, but also at the same time, what is such a sensitive story?
I think the media did a good job. And, you know, in terms of your rollout, Matt, that's all PR related. I mean, Michael Sam had some major PR people and operatives helping him with all this. Howard Bragman was his guy. That's a very well-known publicist, or I shouldn't say publicist, but PR strategist, who helps with the rollout stuff, has relationships with big outlets, and that's how a lot of this stuff happens, including in my place. I mean, it's a relationship business many, many times where a subject decides to pick a place to tell his or her story.
Well, let's just pause right there, Richard, with SI and Jason Collins, as well as LeBron James. This was a big year for athletes telling their story in the first-person perspective, and SI was a big part of that.
Definitely. And, you know, I thought the stories were really interesting and handled well by our place. That said, if you want to get the criticism that comes of those first-person stories where you are ceding some of your editorial mission to a subject, that's fair game to be criticized. I can tell you, people will call me a homer, that's fine. I trust and trusted Lee Jenkins in terms of the process with LeBron, that he is going to do the due diligence in his questions, even though he's putting that in LeBron's first-person narrative, that he's going to perform the journalistic job of asking those questions to do an honest and accurate first-person piece. On top of that, Lee Jenkins did a third-person piece 2 days later, so So I think, you know, for your SI, you got the best of both worlds. Jason Collins, same thing. You'd hope that Franz Liszt and John Wertheim told the story correctly. I feel like they did, but the criticism of that stuff is totally fair, and we're open to that criticism just like other places. But the Sam thing, I thought the Sam story, I thought Michael Sam was covered really, really well. I thought ESPN did a great job during the draft to present all the different facets of that guy's story, including why he may or may not be drafted. They didn't make the guy out to be like J.J. Watt. You know, they legitimately explained why he would be dropping into the seventh round and what his weaknesses and positives were. I thought they were pretty ballsy in terms of showing him kissing his boyfriend on national TV, knowing that they were going to get some people who weren't going to like that. But that was an honest moment. The fact is, Michael Sam's gay. He wanted to celebrate that with his loved ones, and I thought that was good on the NFL Network and good on ESPN for showing that. So in general, I thought the coverage was pretty good. You know, I got a little bit of a speed bump with the Josina Anderson shower report. I did a long piece on that. I thought Josina got a little bit screwed by her own place in terms of how that went down. But, you know, any time, and she could have done a better job of letting the viewer know before that report that, hey, we know that this, some of you are going to think this is tawdry. Here's the reason why I'm reporting this, or here's the reason why I want to discuss this. But all in all, in general, I thought the coverage was pretty good. I think I gave it a B+. And when I talked to the guys at Outside, which is a great website, biggest gay sports website, certainly in this country, I probably can make the argument in the world, I think they gave the Michael Sam coverage a B. So in general, and those guys are pretty hard graders. So in general, I think it was pretty good. I think the media, sports media, has done a pretty good job when it comes to gay athletes, in particular gay athletes coming out, at least.
All right, let's get to Bill Simmons, who made a lot of headlines this year. We talked about some of the criticism of Roger Goodell earlier this year, and the podcast heard round the world with his challenge to ESPN to do something about his comments. Well, they did. They suspended him 3 weeks, which was really shocking. I remember seeing the statement pop up in my inbox, and at the end of it, the very last line, that Bill Simmons was suspended 3 weeks. I mean, I let out an audible whoa that ESPN would deliver such a hefty punishment to him. And of course, the timing with his contract coming up next year, we've seen the creation of the Grantland basketball show. I think the NBA finals with Simmons leaving Countdown was probably best for everyone involved, given his eagerness to maybe not have the time taken away from there, the infamous Sage Steele eye roll. So the year in Simmons that was at ESPN was really maybe the most dramatic we've seen from any one sports personality. I know you had a recent column looking at the odds of where Simmons is going next year. If you can walk us through those and how the suspension and everything else that happened this year is going to impact those odds.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the year in Simmons, talk about a guy who, you know, loves wrestling, is very CM Punk like, you know, we'll see what will happen with him. But yeah, I mean, it was a very busy year for Bill Simmons, from moving on from Countdown to forming his own basketball show, the Grantland basketball show, which is what he's really ultimately wanted, to sort of craft the show in his own vision. Obviously, the suspension will be the biggest story of the year. ESPN suspending him for 3 weeks. Not even, in my opinion, and based on my reporting, for calling Roger Goodell a liar, but for challenging management, for basically calling out management, saying, I dare you to do something. And management, obviously, with so many other employees other than Bill Simmons, I think took a stand more to show everybody else that Bill Simmons was not above the law. I think, obviously, if you look at that suspension versus what else happened at ESPN this year, I think it was an absurd suspension, an absurdly long suspension. The fact that Simmons got 2 more weeks than Stephen A. Smith is ridiculous, and I'm not sure either guy should have been suspended. But, you know, the length of that suspension, in my opinion, was ludicrous. It was also 2 weeks of paid suspension. I'm sorry, he lost 2 weeks of salary, where many others at ESPN, when they've been suspended, have not had to lose salary. And that, and Simmons' salary is a big salary, so that was not a small decision. What it means heading forward, I think, for him is, and again, he has not talked at all on the record about any of this. I don't imagine he will until he makes his decision later next year. But I think he will. I think this year did give him pause in terms of really thinking about what he wants to do for the future. I don't doubt that he loves being at Grantland. I think he likes all the people he hired. He basically handpicked all his hires, so he's working with his pals. He's working with his buddies on the podcast and at ESPN Films. He makes a ton of money. So he has a very, very good life, a lot of power, and an incredible distribution engine. That said, I think he's incredibly pissed off that he was suspended and called out. I think there's a part of him that would really like to see if he could leave ESPN and take some audience with him. He certainly would take some staffers with him. So I think he's really going to investigate it. You know, I'm not in a position where I would really know, like, what is realistic? I mean, would there be some money person who would say, all right, here's $30 million. We're going to give you your own site, platform, YouTube channel and make this happen? You know, he's given his position as the country's most popular or well-known sports writer. He has and obviously the fact that he, you know, he's close and friendly with a lot of Hollywood people who have some cash. He's in a position unlike every other sports writer has ever been, including Rick Riley or any of these other big guys who had a chance to move somewhere else. So he has a real shot to actually pull off, one, an independent site if he wants it, or two, he certainly has a shot to go to any one of these new age places, Vox Media, Vice Media, Bleacher Report, which could throw him a ton of money and game change, I think, their, I don't say reputation, but certainly game change their traffic. So he's going to have a ton of options. And then on top of the fact, I think at a certain point, John Skipper is going to have a long sit down with him. And I think it's important for Skipper to keep him. I think, you know, they don't want to lose that digital traffic and what Grantland represents. So he's probably in one of the better positions we've ever seen anyone in the sports media be in. But I do think he's ticked off at ESPN. The question will be, is he ticked off enough to really change his entire life and leave? Or is he just ticked off to the point where he's just going to try to stick it to him for some more money and stuff like that?
Well, and the more I think about this, Richard, now would be the time to go and try something independent. And as you said, no writer, certainly in sports, has the resources or the following or the connection that Simmons does. And if you look at where the entire media industry is heading with everyone, you know, whether from sports leagues, entertainment, going over the top and straight to consumers. I mean, to think of all the options and the things that Bill Simmons could do to bypass ESPN and to go straight to the fan, whether it be YouTube or streaming or website, to follow that independent Glenn Beck-like model. I mean, I think in a sense, Richard, he's done almost everything you could do at ESPN without being president of the network. When you look at Grantland 30 for 30, this would be the chance, though, to go independent, to do something on his own, and to finally be free of all the butting of the heads that he's had with management over the years. And I just think where the media world is heading, there's such a unique opportunity here that, you know, if Simmons does this now, he could really get out ahead and change the game versus, you know, 2, 3, 4 years from now, where maybe some of these independent sites, some of these opportunities are already entrenched or passed them by. It's very interesting, the timing of it, as far as Simmons' contract coming up and just where we are in the media landscape right now.
I agree with everything you said. I think it's a unique time. I think there's money out there to start some kind of independent, you know, independent place. I mean, they've already started. The one thing, though, and I think Bill is smart enough to know this, is that it's very hard to distribute your stuff when you first start, even if it's a place that has money. It's just it's a long go, and you got to be in it for the long haul. The great thing about ESPN is that, you know, you're part of this empire, and they can get your stuff to millions and millions of eyeballs. If he goes somewhere, if he starts a brand new enterprise, it's, you know, he's going to have to be satisfied with much less goals than he had before. But I agree with you. I think it's a really interesting time for him to do this. I also think he's in a great position because he's made a lot of money. So this is a guy who's got some money in the bank. It's not like if this thing blows up, Bill Simmons is, you know, he's going to be struggling to work at Walmart or something like that. He's got millions of dollars in the bank, and those are the kind of people that you can really roll the dice. I should say those are the kind of people, but because of that, it gives him a lot of financial freedom to roll the dice and take a shot on something new, where if you were somebody else, just a, you know, a contract employee, and you didn't have that kind of money in the bank, it might be harder. So I don't know what he's going to do. I had for such a long time thought he was going to stay at ESPN. That would still be my prediction. But my, you know, if I was going to odds it out, there would have been a time where I thought it would have been he was 1-3 to stay at ESPN. And now I think it's more 2-1, 2.5-1. So, you know, if I was a Vegas odds maker, my odds are changing.
Simmons, of course, wasn't the only notable suspension at ESPN this year. Dan Le Batard, Keith Law, Max Kellerman, Stephen A. Smith. What did you make of the rash of suspensions this year handed down in Bristol?
I think Bristol needs to get out of the junior high school business, generally speaking, when it comes at least comes to Twitter suspensions. Nothing more silly than to suspend someone from Twitter, especially when they just basically switch to Facebook or Instagram after you suspend them on Twitter. I think the rash of suspensions comes from management's attempt to try to sort of corral things. For a long time, the suspensions were, I wouldn't say uneven, but the decision on who was suspended and who was not just was so willy-nilly. There just seemed to be no rhyme or reason as to why one person would be suspended, why someone else wasn't. So I think they've made a decision to let their employees know that there are things that cannot be done, and if you do this, you're going to be suspended. Obviously, each case is an individual case, and that's what ESPN management will say. We take each case individually. And I guess I believe that to an extent, but I do think there's been some messaging going on to the rank and file. The Law suspension, you know, was just an example of just that's just outthinking yourself. You know, I don't think his Law was suspended because he was, debating or he was advocating scientific theory over creationism. I believe he was suspended because management was not happy that he's been combative on Twitter against other ESPN employees. But, you know, I don't even think it's clear if Law was ever warned or not. And he's, you know, and then on top of that, the person he was debating with, Curt Schilling, did not get any kind of suspension. So it just the unevenness of all this stuff still is just very befuddling and weird. And I think a lot of times it also has to do with where things are in the news cycle, if there are other organizations who are starting to pepper ESPN. Like Stephen A. Smith, let's face it, they eventually made their move because it started going, leaving from sports to going to like Now, National Organization for Women and stuff like that. So they wanted to end the news cycle because I think they were getting scared that some political groups were starting to take notice of this.
Well, if I remember, it took such a long time for them to act on Stephen A. Smith as well.
Correct, because this is another thing too. They generally speaking, need others to sort of let them know and alert them that, oh my God, maybe something happened here. If you remember, this was the same case with the Rob Smith cornball brother on RG3. Nothing happened. I mean, they replayed that show. So clearly both First Take producers and management didn't think there was an issue with it. And then once I think it got into the press, maybe the Washington Post was the first place or whoever else, then they started a big game of CYA. So it's still, that place is still sort of in the weird netherworld of inconsistent suspensions. There's a good argument to be made and a good discussion to be had. Should these suspensions even exist? You know, Awful Announcing probably has its own rules of suspension. SI does. There are not many people over the years in my 15 years at SI that have ever been suspended here. I can think of like maybe two off the top of my head. But ESPN is a different place and it's Disney. But it's always weird to me, man. It's the idea of sort of like suspending people is weird. And then on top of that, the idea of suspending people from social media is really spectacularly weird. That to me always feels like junior high.
You mentioned Stephen A. Smith and his comments, and we could spend another hour on everything First Take did this year, but that would just require more therapy. So moving on from that, I want to launch into something that I think was an important discussion this year. And Stephen A. Smith's comments might have been the low point of this, but this entire discussion surrounding women in sports media, and full disclosure, you mentioned some of our policies. We had to fire a writer, one of our editors, Steve Lepore, when we found out about some harassing direct messages that were sent towards women, which was a tough thing to go through, to see everything that had happened with that. And of course, our support's with everyone that was on the wrong side of that. But if you look at what happened there, Adrian Dater, the Avalanche writer for the Denver Post, look at some of the comments that were made this year with Stephen A. Smith, some of the radio bros around the country, especially WEEI in Boston, which were pretty embarrassing as far as their comments on Aaron Andrews. But then, Richard, I think there were a lot of progress made this year. You look at Jemele Hill, Jane McManus, Sarah Spain, those people giving more commentary on ESPN platforms, given a larger role. You look at what CBS Sports Network has done with We Need to Talk and giving more very talented women a larger platform and a dedicated show. So I think this year has really been introspective as far as the role of women in sports media. Of course, your reporting with Pam Oliver is another big storyline in this department. I feel like this year we had to ask some very tough questions of the sports media, media as a whole, sports as a whole. And hopefully, even though there were definitely some growing pains this year, hopefully this was a year where some progress was made. The arrow is trending in the right direction overall. What are your thoughts on that?
I'd say it's both. You sort of just presented a pretty good case for both sides. So I think there were, there were some really cool things that happened this year. We Need to Talk comes on the air, which, I think I wrote at one point that the most endangered species in sports is a woman offering her opinion on television. It just doesn't exist. So that show existing is a success. Whether the show is good or not is almost secondary. The fact that the show exists, I think, is a huge success for women because, now they can go on and have this show where they can offer opinion on anything under the sun as opposed to being, ghettoized in sideline reporting positions. And there's no doubt that show is a work in progress. That show is not always great by any means. But the fact that the show exists is really good. And the fact that CBS put it on and supported it is excellent. We did see some really good work by women, as we've seen every year. Particularly, obviously, Jane McManus and Jemele, they're going to get highlighted on the domestic violence issue because ESPN put them front and center on a lot of very high-profile programs where that was a factor. Kate Fagan, you saw her as well. Not that I particularly like the show by any means, but even Kate Fagan doing Around the Horn is like a step in the right direction because for so long that show has just been about like putting bros on, to give their 15 seconds of hot takes and get points from Tony Reale. Do you win something at the end of it? You get to go to the circus or something?
Well,
I'm not sure.
Richard, that's interesting because I think if you look at Around the Horn, and this is just maybe a microcosm of where we are and hopefully where we're going, when that show started, it was a bunch of the establishment old white guys, basically,
correct,
for lack of a better term, sports writer.
I agree.
And now you've got Kate Fagan, Bomani Jones, Pablo Torre. I mean, it's a much younger, diverse crowd.
Totally agree. Yeah. I got my issues with that show. To their credit, though, Eric Reinholm and Aaron Solomon have been really, really good about adding diverse voices to that show, and props to them on that. Yeah, you have your issues of whether a show where sports writers bark like seals for money is good, but within that ecosystem, I think it's great that they've opened the gates up and that they've brought in new voices. With all that said, in terms of all the excellent work and all the things that, obviously we should mention Rachel Nichols too, had an excellent year, very prominent, and good to see good work being rewarded on her end. But, with all the stuff that went down, that was good. And also, let's mention Katie Nolan, too, and her excellent video commentary that really really called out a lot of different places when it comes to women in sports. With all that being said, we still, on a daily basis, see women attacked massively on social media, especially women in I shouldn't say especially, but women in the sports media get a ton of that all the time. As you know, I've done many panels this year, Matt. I've talked to at least close to 100 women in the business. And there's not one of them that doesn't say that on a daily basis, especially if they're active on Twitter, and you have to be to push your work and brand, et cetera, where they're not being called sexist names, they're not being sexualized, the commentary doesn't come their way that's sexualized. Jemele Hill told me, not that I thought this couldn't be the case because I do live in 2014, but the idea that she said every single day on Twitter, someone drops the N-word on her. Not every week, every day. That's unbelievable that we're still in this nonsense place in 2014. So for all the progress that women have made, they still have to deal with this kind of nonsense all the time. And on top of that, we're still not even close to any kind of near equality within people getting positions. You don't see any kind of women doing NFL play-by-play. You have one woman essentially doing major college football, Beth Mowins. You have Doris Burke, who's a trailblazer in the NBA and Sage Steele a little bit. But generally speaking, I mean, the major sports, we still don't see women in these very, very high-profile positions. There's one woman directing the NFL, Suzanne Smith. No women who are producing the NFL. So, well, yeah, there's some strides that have been made. The industry remains incredibly, incredibly male-dominated. And we've got a long way to go. You just hope that you're going to get some progressive people who are out there who are hiring people and who make some smart decisions and who can help sort of change the game. But there's still a ton of work to be done.
You're on Twitter a lot. I'm on Twitter a lot. It's a major part of what we do. This year, Richard, I noticed myself even taking a bit of a step back from Twitter just because of some of the nasty comments. You can label it trolling or whatever, but just some of the virulent behavior that takes place on a daily basis. I mean, I think I got out the block button probably for, you know, the first time this year and used it quite a bit, actually, just because, you know, people say things on Twitter that you would never say to anyone standing next to them or in front of them in real life. I just don't know if you've noticed this as well. It just seems like Twitter this year was a bit of a darker place than I remember it being. And I hope that's not the case moving forward, because I think Twitter has been such a game changer, maybe the most important game changer in our industry over the past several years. I just would hate to lose it to this element that exists, this underworld of Twitter.
Yeah, it has. I mean, you know, I'm not going to play like sort of the old man card, because it is what it is, and you got to live and you got to deal with it. But there is no doubt, in my opinion, that Twitter, the last year and a half or so on Twitter, at least in the, I'll limit it to the sports world, because I try to use specifics. I have no doubt that when it comes to politics and race and other stuff, it's as bad. But within sports, there seems to have been an amp up when it comes to really kind of angry, negative, I don't even want to say outrage, but this just, you're correct. It's just the discourse is just very attacking almost on a daily basis. It's very hard to say something on Twitter where, unless you spell it out, people are going to try to find fault with it. And I don't know what that is. I don't know why that is the case. You know, I don't know what that says about us or about the anonymity of social media. And there's no doubt that you are correct. You would say things on social media. I'm guilty of this too, that you would probably not say things to people if you were standing next to them. I think some of it is a product of just the way, you know, 20-somethings, early 30-somethings, sort of the discourse of how they are, because so much of their communication is done electronically, that you act differently in social media or in electronics than you would in real life talking to people. That said, I still believe in Twitter. I still think it's an incredible resource. It's by far the best news resource I've ever been a part of, because I can get all, you know, the people and the publications that I like and enjoy reading right to my inbox as opposed to anywhere else. I still think it's an incredible medium for change and social change and for news. There's no doubt it has helped me immeasurably. It has absolutely raised my platform significantly. There's maybe more than anything in my entire career, and maybe even more than being at SI, which obviously is a big platform. So I wouldn't leave it, but I'm with you. This, you know, there was a point early on in Twitter I didn't block anybody. I changed that about a year and a half ago. I have no problems blocking people. And it's fascinating that you know what it is? I just find there's a lot of anger out there among certain people. And it's always male, generally speaking, and it's usually young. And I don't know why that is on social media. And there's no doubt that I probably have written some things, certainly about media stuff, that probably piss people off and get people a little bit ticked. But usually the reaction to that is an overreaction. You know, it's like if I say something, people will come back at you as if you've just, like, attacked their family. And that's kind of weird. A lot of that is, I think, the anonymity of the platform. The fact is that you don't have to have any kind of dialogue with somebody face-to-face, where even if you dislike somebody, I think there would just be a humanity to you. Or like a, you know, I have major issues with Rovell, obviously, but if we were one-on-one sitting across from each other at a table, the discourse course, I think would be polite enough. It wouldn't be a scene from Pulp Fiction where we're blasting each other. So I don't know. I mean, I agree. The short answer, man, I know I just rambled it. The short answer is I agree with you. I don't know why that is. I'm not going to give up on that. But I have read a lot of stories away from sports media where people have said Twitter took a turn this year and that they're leaving the service. I'm obviously not going to do that, but it is – it did dramatic – for whatever reason, and it dramatically felt a little angry this year to me.
Well, and with that, you've got so many straw men nowadays, like the outrage police and clickbait, right. And you could go on for weeks talking about these things, but that's why I bring it up, because it is interesting. I think I've seen some of those pieces, too, where independent of our little circles, and Twitter can be such an insular place at times,
definitely,
that it does seem like overall there was a bit of a turn this year. So hopefully 2015 will bring about a change in the right direction. All right, quickly, Fox Sports 1, I want to hit on their first full year. A lot of hype, a lot of excitement. A lot of jabs being thrown across the coast at Bristol. Not a lot of results. I think the term mixed bag would be very generous to Fox Sports 1 in terms of ratings. And I look at it, Richard, one of the stories we've been following is this kind of race for the number two sports media brand. I know, ESPN folks will say, well, ESPN's a number one network. ESPN's number two, or ESPN2 is number two, and so on. But if you look at that competition between FS1 and NBCSN, FS1's the one that makes a lot of noise, says we're going to challenge ESPN, go toe-to-toe with Bristol. Fox College Saturday gets the can. Crowd Goes Wild gets the can. Fox Sports Live, head-to-head with SportsCenter, still struggling. NBCSN's kind of the tortoise in the race. They're playing to their niche audiences. They're owning the EPL, doing a tremendous job with it. F1 saw ratings increases. Sochi Olympics did great for the network, obviously. And that battle is much tighter than I think anyone in the industry would have thought. Of course, FS1's probably going to pull ahead with MLB playoffs and some of those audiences as far as the year goes. But I think if you talk to some of the dedicated media observers, they'd say from a quality standpoint, NBCSN does a really, really good job. It's probably ahead of Fox Sports 1 right now. It's just such an interesting dynamic, Richard, because you have these two 24/7 upstart cable networks, two totally different strategies, and each kind of carving out their space in the world?
Yeah, that's actually that's well said by you. I don't think ESPN's take that ESPN2 is the number two cable network is unfair. And I think if you look at the ratings, generally speaking, and you guys do this really, really well, better than me, in fact, in terms of sort of like tracking this on a weekly, daily basis. I think that's probably a fair statement, and I think that's a statement that probably can be backed up by metrics that ESPN2 over year to year is the number two cable sports network. But the more interesting story, I agree with you, is where does everything stand here between Fox Sports 1, which has a ton of money behind Fox, ESPN, and NBC Sports Network? And I absolutely agree. The more quality network right now between Fox Sports 1 and NBC, and between NBC Sports Network and Fox Sports 1, it's not close. NBC Sports Network is a better network in terms of editorial. They have, in terms of the best package editorially, the Premier League blows anything Fox Sports 1 does out of the water. It's not close, in fact, I would say. Fox Sports 1 does certainly have some really good properties in baseball, and they got some good college football. Obviously, UFC, they do really well. But NBC Sports Network, what they have, they do exceptionally well on a production end, from the NHL to the Premier League that I mentioned. I think they do horse racing really well. Obviously, when the Olympics come around, that's a high quality program. What NBC Sports Network is going to struggle with is the day-to-day stuff during the NFL season. I don't know how many people watch their 5-6 block in the same way. I don't think a ton of people at this point still are watching like America's pregame, etc. Fox Sports Live, that's the one sort of interesting show here in all this mix, because NBC has decided at this point not to go against SportsCenter. They've made a decision that they're not going to throw the money to try to compete on a level basis. Fox has said they are. And at this point, Fox Sports Live, and you guys have chronicled this significantly, has made no inroads on SportsCenter. They will get good ratings when they have a great lead-in, and usually like a college football lead-in. Fox Sports Live will get a really good number, and then the next day the number will be crazy. I mean, you guys have written about this. One day they'll have Fox Sports Live will have like 700,000 people watching.
Right. One day, I think after the MLB postings, and it was like a 97% audience drop or something insane like that.
Right.
But that's where this whole idea of expectations come into play, because I feel like when we're sitting here now at the end of 2014, we're looking at Fox Sports 1 as a disappointment because of all of the bluster and all of the hype coming from the folks at Fox, from Rupert Murdoch and his minions. And we're looking at NBCSN largely as a success, because they aren't building up any false expectations. They're not looking at false pretenses. They're not saying, hey, we want to conquer this space. They're just doing what they do and doing it well. So you've got two networks that are very close in terms of audience numbers, sports rights, what they do. But we look at one much more positively than the other because of the expectations and the narratives attached therein.
Probably true. Well, I would also say that I think NBC Sports gets the benefit of that because I think their programming is better. I think what they've done, especially with the Premier League, is just a better product than whatever the best thing Fox Sports 1 has done. What Fox Sports 1 has to improve on top of the fact that it must market its network more so that people know where it appears on their specific cable dial, they have to figure out what is up with Fox Sports Live. The show is a mess. It doesn't mean it's a bad show. It's just a mess. It doesn't know what it is. Is it a straight traditional highlight show? Is it this debate show? Is it this mix of both, in which obviously the latter is what they've tried it to be and it hasn't worked? They need to really, you know, is it any, does it ever offer any kind of unexpected features that you'd be like, wow, that's kind of cool the way SportsCenter does? And occasionally, you know, Fox has occasionally done that, but not much. It's not destination or compelling programming right now. And the Fox guys will get mad at me when I say that, but like, tuning in to hear Donovan McNabb, you know, talk to fellow athlete X about topic Y, it's just, not only is it not creative, it's not compelling. I like Onright and Dan O'Toole, and Jan Wright and Dan O'Toole, we've written that. I think you guys do too, but that's not enough. It's not enough to just have two kind of amusing anchors who can deliver the news. That's not going to beat SportsCenter. Because those two guys are not Oberman and Patrick, and it's not 1995, and nobody's going to a network just for two personalities. So that show has to sort of, I would think, figure out what it is. And as I've said many times, the show occasionally, I think one way they could really compete with ESPN, and even if they could, not competing on their viewership numbers at the minute, but eventually long-term they would get more, is they have to break some news on that show or around that show. And Fox doesn't. Glazer's a newsbreaker, but if you notice, Glazer holds all his stuff for Sunday.
Yeah.
Because he wants the biggest possible audience. So, and I've told this to the Fox people, that one of the things I kind of judge my own, forget about the fact that I write about this stuff, but as a viewer, I judge myself on if a news breaks, what place do I want to go to where I feel like I'm going to get the whole story or I'm going to really be inundated with interesting coverage, you know, let's say there's an OJ chase again or something like that. And 99.9 people in this country, I think, would still de facto go to ESPN because I think they feel that that's still a news organization, even if they have like their issues with it. And Fox Sports Live, Fox Sports 1 has to get to a point where they change some people's minds and that becomes a de facto place to go to. But right now, you just wouldn't go there. I'm not even sure if like a major, major story broke out. Like who would be the Bob Lee for Fox Sports 1? Who is it?
I don't think there is one right now. No.
Yeah, like, so it's, you know, they got hoodwinked, I think, by some of their marketing and business people somehow, that, like, the world was, thought that ESPN was some intellectual Nate Silver egg house place, and that if you brought in some best damn sports show kind of commentary, people were going to flock to it. That was a fallacy, and two, that was a terrible decision by the management to listen to that kind of nonsense, because it's not true. People, generally speaking, do not think of ESPN as a bastion of intellectualism, but they do give it enough credibility where they'll go to it if real sports news breaks out. So my advice for Fox would be to sort of turn it up a little bit and get a little smarter and to treat your audience a little bit smarter than what you were initially going for. And it can be done. Fox is the one thing that you need to change anything, and that's money. So we'll see what they do heading forward.
Rest in peace. Hashtag the one for fun. Richard's media awards are out at Sports Illustrated. Doc Emrick, the person of the year. Mike Tirico honored. Rachel Nichols, Chris Carter, Most Improved. One I want to hone in on is your selection of Ian Dark and Taylor Twellman as your broadcast team of the year. Of course, this is the last year of ESPN's World Cup coverage. Twellman signed a big contract extension at ESPN. Alexi Lalas jumping ship following the World Cup over to Fox. The biggest story, of course, in the soccer space, and I think you and I are probably on the same page in rating ESPN's World Cup coverage very highly, is what happens now with Fox taking over, and specifically in the PG era, the post-Gus era. The experiment's over. Gus Johnson as a soccer announcer is now a past tense item. Where does Fox go now? And looking back, why did that fail so spectacularly?
I don't know if I wouldn't call it a failure. Others would.
You wouldn't call it a failure?
No, I think it wasn't a success. Doesn't necessarily mean it's a failure. It's that they eventually pulled the plug before they would have known whether how the public would react. And I think the only way you could say that would have been a failure, pure failure, is if you went through the World Cup and he totally bailed and had a terrible World Cup, and then people were like, this was the worst decision ever. I just feel like they pulled the plug before an end result could be reached. But if you want to call it a failure, I mean, there's certainly an argument to be made that the fact is that if he didn't make it till the end, he's a quote-unquote failure. I understand why they pulled the plug. I think, depending on who you talk to, they sort of eventually came to a decision that Gus was never going to be able to get the reps to get to the place where he could get to. The question would be, could any American announcer with where Gus was get to that place?
Well, and that's the one thing about it, Richard, because it just seemed like such a flawed strategy from the get-go. We're going to take this guy who's maybe called two or three games on the radio in MLS, and we're going to throw him into the fire of Bayern Munich and Manchester United in front of the what I consider to be the toughest announcing graders in sports, which are European soccer fans. And we're just going to throw him into the deep end of the pool with no life raft, no floaties, no nothing, and hope he somehow survives. And
all true. And I agree with you. I think it was a long shot for him to ever find, to ever really sort of find incredible success. The only reason I'm saying it's not a I'm playing semantic games here. If you want to call it a failure, I would never argue with you. I'm not calling it a failure because to me, the word failure would have been like to see like it go to the end, and then if you really, really sort of screwed up or really was getting crushed, then you sort of call it a failure. But to me, it just sort of like feels like just a DNF basically more than a failure. That said, to answer your question at the top, I don't think Fox knows where it's going heading forward. I think they obviously need a number one announcer. I think that it's really important to them to have an American voice as that number one. Now, to me, I think that's nonsense. I think you should have the best voice, whoever it is in soccer. But Fox is very big on sort of cementing their own or an American voice there, which is why they, which is why they invested in Gus. So you can look at some American. It's not going to be JD Delacamera. You can look at some American people who worked with Fox. And maybe that person will, sort of get the number one assignment, or at least the U.S. assignment. I think you will see Martin Tyler calling the World Cup there. It's very possible they will sign Dark when his contract is up. So I think you will see a number of good soccer announcers, although I don't know if those guys will be the quote-unquote number one. Maybe Tyler would be. He has a relationship with Fox, and maybe for the quote-unquote the World Cup, they would sign him as their number one. What's going to be really important for Fox is to watch them, how they put the Women's World Cup on. Mm-hmm. They've already been talking a big game. Not too long ago, I wrote a big piece on all their plans in terms of they don't have all the specifics yet, but they sort of gave me an outline on what their coverage is going to be. And there's, it's a massive commitment. They have a massive amount of hours. They just signed Lawless, obviously, so they're putting their studio teams in place. So we'll see how they handle that. And you'll get a sense of what kind of professionalism they're going to do for a big soccer tournament with the Women's World Cup, and that will give you a little bit of a precursor to 2018. But they have a lot of work to do because, as I've said, the Fox guys don't particularly like this, but I think it's true. There's a massive amount of skepticism when it comes to how the hardcore soccer fan thinks Fox is going to cover the World Cup. And I think they've earned that skepticism from how they've kind of previously approached the sport. And they've approached the sport too much like kind of Foxified. And the Gus Johnson hire was a total foxified hire, whether you liked him or not. So we will see what they do heading forward. That's a really interesting story that's going to play out in the next couple of years.
This year brought about quite a bit of innovation. I think that was one of the good things this year in sports media, whether it was the BCS Megacast or what we saw at the Final Four with the team casts, some of the different streaming things that were out there, alternate feeds if you look at what happens with Grantland and what Fox did during the MLB postseason. What one innovation or new idea that happened in sports media this year was the best in your mind?
I would say putting Rick Riley on Monday Night Football. All right, what am I thinking about this new innovation? Thank you. What's the best new innovation? Maybe the Megacast, and just the notion of trying to do some interesting things on the second screen from the BCS film room that ESPN did for the national championship game to CBS and Turner making an attempt with the hometown team cast on the NCAA championships, even if you thought those were like ridiculous and over the top, which they were kind of fun. So I think to me, this notion of, or this additive programming for the second screen, whether it's a laptop or an iPad or a mobile phone, the idea that you can get sort of this interesting secondary kind of broadcast in addition to the main broadcast is really interesting. And I think only going to continue to grow heading forward.
And ultimately,
think about it. And I'm probably missing something, but that's the one that came immediately to mind. Just this idea that, like, these mega events. Now you're getting different kind of an interesting kind of programming around it.
Well, that's what I wrote too about the Megacast, is that, you know, we've watched football in roughly the same way for 50, 60 years, and here at ESPN through the Megacast brought about a new way to watch it. So anytime you can bring about that kind of change and something that is very well received by viewers and being innovative, I think it's definitely a good thing. All right, we've covered a ton of ground here. We're going over an hour for the podcast.
Jesus, I know. You told me 30 minutes, man. I mean,
but I warned you.
I'm being paid zero for this. Unlike other awful announcing guests who I know get paid.
Whoa.
I feel like this is just,
back up.
How much more blood can I give you, man?
Well, we'll take this out of the cut for next year.
Who was the last podcast guest before me?
It's been a couple weeks. I want to say Sarah Spain was the last one.
Sarah Spain, yeah, all right. And who was it before Sarah Spain?
I think it might have been Jim Nantz.
Yeah.
Right. You're in good company, Richard. So, you know,
I gotta believe. I think I'm almost fairly certain I'm the least paid among those three.
Look, we'll see if the checks can clear ending 2014, and we'll try and tack this on to 2015.
All right. Tell Ben Koo to get his accountants going. Mail it to 6th Avenue in Manhattan, please.
I'll see what I can do. We'll personally deliver it. All right. Before we get to looking ahead to 2015, we've covered a lot of ground here. You obviously had your media awards. Is there something that maybe you wanted to include in the column or something we haven't touched on today that you wanted to lift up and spotlight and give some praise to from what you saw in sports media in 2014?
Yeah, I want to talk about how fabulous I am, Matt, and what great year I had, because, I mean, it's truly incredible.
Well, you know, anytime you can smack down Piers Morgan on Twitter and get Chrissy Teigen and John Legend.
First of all, so no one gets outraged. I was kidding there. let me think about this. I feel, you know what? I can already
sense the emails coming in, Richard.
I know. The tweets are coming. I don't know. I kind of wish that I gave my pal, but also somebody who did great work, Jay McManus, some love in the column. I don't think I did. That might have been a bit of an oversight. You know, I can certainly avoid this if I want to, but I won't. There were people who criticized me for not mentioning Peter King and some of his reporting with Roger Goodell on the column. I think that's fair. I mean, I've said a million times, I don't cover Sports Illustrated. I think you should read Deadspin, Awful Announcing, The Big Lead, New York Times, Boston Globe, USA Today, whoever else covers Sports Illustrated. I totally advocate you reading them. I hope they cover us as hard as hell. But having worked here as long as I do, I don't cover this place. I don't think you should want me to cover this place, being that I cannot be objective the way you would want a reporter to be objective with my colleagues. That being said, Peter King did, he put put out some bad reporting this year. He owned it and explained what he did, and now it's up to you as a reader to decide whether you trust him or not. And I think there's one thing that if I should have included in the column, I think I should have included some kind of nod to that. The issue or problem there, though, is you put that in, and then you're going to get basically like, well, why didn't you include this part about Peter King? You know, it's sort of a never-ending cycle. But if the two things I kind of, if I'm looking at in hindsight, that I wish I did, one, I wish I gave Jay McManus some more depth, and two, I probably should have put some kind of acknowledgement that, yeah, I saw that King screwed up. I understand people are pissed at that. You got to now make the decision whether you trust him or not. And I will say, for the record, by the way, I work for Peter King on MMQB. You know, work sort of is in quotes. It's a big staff. I don't, he's not per se editing my piece. Others are, but I do work for him. I do respect him. I've known him for a long time. I like him personally. So, so you got to know where I'm coming from on that. But those would be the two, I think, off the top of my head that I can think of. I'm trying to think of something else. What else that I might have missed, Matt? I mean, you know, you could always argue on any of these awards that I hit it right or I screwed up. I will say this. This is my last thing, and I realize I'm filibustering here. But over the years when I've done media awards, usually every year there are people who are complaining left and right about the lead award. And if I wanted to, I could just choose somebody that's easily polarizing and I can double my page views. Had I chose Bill Simmons this year, I don't even know what the page views were on the piece. I'm sure in the hundreds of thousands. I would have doubled that easily by choosing him. It would have been an easy decision. People would have gone left and right. But I chose Emmerich because I really thought he had an incredible year, and I thought he was the right selection. And this is the first time in 8 years of me doing this that I have had barely anyone complain about the lead selection. There's been a couple, but I would say out of like between Twitter and other places, like the 150, 200 comments I've gotten on the piece, like I would say literally like less than 10 people have complained about the selection. So that's been kind of interesting and stunning to me that, you know, it's like the first time where my person of the year has almost been universally accepted. That is a first for me, at least in the 8 years I've been doing these awards.
Well, and we talked about some of the negativity that exists out there. Mike Emmerich may be the one person who is bulletproof.
Maybe we finally have Vin Scully. Maybe we found the two guys.
I think that's it. That's the list. All right. Finally, as we get out of here, give me one item for your 2015 wish list. What's one thing you want to see happen in sports media? Then give me one prediction for next year.
The one prediction I'll give you is that CBS will retain the NFL Thursday Night Package, and if not for multiple years other than one, and the package will, if it's not 16 games on CBS, it'll be between 12 and 16. In terms of the, what's my one wish list for 2015 in the sports media? You might have stumped me, Matt.
Darren Revelle to follow you.
I guess I would like to see, you know, hopefully there's just not going to be like, hopefully someone's not going to be doing, hopefully, I guess my wish list would be for me not to do something spectacularly stupid to get fired or anything like that. To be honest, you know, now that I have twins, I need to behave myself and not be a knucklehead. So I think if I'm going to wish for anything, it's going to be, I wish for me not to do something stupid, and usually that would mean for me to be very smart on Twitter. So I'm going to wish something for myself is to sort of be, you know, if there are times I hope in 2015 where right before I hit send, I think to myself twice and maybe eliminate the tweet.
The Twitter filter, I think that's a good idea for the 2015 wish list. All right, let's get out of here. You mentioned the twins. Congratulations on that. As a twin myself, I know that's a life-changing thing, so congrats on that. All right, follow Richard at Richard Deitch. Make sure he stays out of trouble in 2015. And, of course, read all of his excellent work at SI.com. Richard, thanks again. A pleasure, and hopefully we'll both be around to do this next year.
Happy holidays to you, Matt, and to the Awful Announcing listeners. Thanks again.